This is the UK Financial Intelligence Unit podcast.
Hello and welcome to the UK Financial Intelligence Unit podcast. My name is David Maguire and I'm a senior officer in the UK FIU. Now, the aim of these podcasts is educational, offering guidance regarding the Suspicious Activity Reports, or SARS, regime, and opinions expressed by panellists are independently theirs. Now, as the number of choices available to banking customers in the UK has grown to include non-traditional platforms, the pool of institutions that regularly report SARS has expanded and diversified. So, I'm going to start this podcast with a question. Do you know what's meant by the terms Challenger Bank, Digital Bank, Fintech, e-wallet, e-money, cryptocurrency exchange, etc.? Well, these terms are now commonplace within the SARS regime, and the terminology used to discuss these reporters can be crucial to understanding the different services that they offer. In this podcast, I'll be chatting to Mike Venn, who's the Group Head of Risk and Compliance with Modular, to try and get a better understanding of this area. Mike, if I can welcome you to the podcast. Now, you heard the list of terms I cited in the introduction. How would you describe Modular?
Thank you, David. So, yeah, I wouldn't pigeonhole us into one particular category that you read out there. Effectively, we are a regulated e-money institution who specialise and focus on payments. So Modular, set up in 2016, really had sort of three core principles at its heart. One was to develop and implement great technology and products that really took a lot of the pain out of payment processing, and linked to that, made sure that the solutions were easily integrated into a whole variety of different business environments through an API-based solution. The second bit really was to make sure that we developed a deep understanding and knowledge of the clients and sectors, in particular businesses that we were going to operate with. And by doing that, we could really tailor and understand both our compliance solutions, but also our product solutions to meet that outcome. And then the third element was complementing those two tech and product solutions with a very strong focus on regulation and achieving a strong regulatory footprint. So in the UK and the Netherlands, we're a regulated e-money institution. And in the UK, we're also one of the few non-banks that have managed to achieve direct access to the UK payments infrastructure. And that drives two key benefits for us as a business. One, it reduces our dependencies on more established financial institutions who won't have the benefit of the technology and solutions we have. So we go direct to the UK payments market. But secondly, it also allows us to engage and interact as a regulated firm with our key regulators to make sure, A, we have even further incentive to operate in a sound, sustainable, safe way, and B, we can really start to support the dialogue about how the FCA, other regulators, continue to innovate and support consumer choice and business choice in the payments infrastructure and market. So effectively, our specialism is payments, and we achieve that access to the market through being regulated as an e-money institution.
So obviously, you mentioned that you don't see yourselves as any of those kind of like labels that I mentioned earlier. So just for the purposes of this question, then I'm going to use Challenger Bank in inverted commas. Is it a prerequisite that for a UK-based SAR reporter to be considered a Challenger Bank, that they should hold a UK banking license? Or is it not as clear as this? Has this become less clear where emerging, often mobile-based firms offer particular services to kind of challenge the market, but without themselves becoming licensed banks?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very sort of subtle but important point, and one that's very close naturally to our regulators in the UK to make sure that consumers do understand what permissions and what authorities businesses have. The starting point is that a business or a regulated entity shouldn't refer to itself as a bank unless it has that regulatory permission. Having said that, the phrase in the market, in the industry, in media can be applied in different contexts and to mean different things. But there are important differences between how a bank will handle the services that it offers and protect customers' funds, and also how a firm like an e-money institution like Modular will manage and protect funds. And as you'd expect, those are the things that the regulator looks to develop and design in the regulatory frameworks to make sure they're proportionate and relevant to that type of business. So an important piece from a safeguarding consumer protection standpoint is that the bank customers are protected through the FSCS, or the Financial Services Compensation Scheme, and that provides an insurance threshold of around about £85,000 per individual, as opposed to how e-money institutions are expected to handle funds, which is called safeguarding. And that actually provides full coverage and protection, and the funds that we hold on behalf of our customers have to be ring-fenced, identifiable, and outside of our own funds. So in the event that either a bank or an e-money institution fails, the funds that are held by us on behalf of the customers are proportionately and relevantly protected so that they can get those funds back and operate with confidence. But the term bank is a very defined one in UK regulation, and is one that the regulator focuses on very heavily to make sure that firms that are operating in this environment don't mislead or confuse consumers by positioning themselves as something they don't have permissions to do.
That kind of links into my next question, which is, with services such as prepaid cards, currency exchange, peer-to-peer payments, etc., whilst these firms are offering services that might see them compete with established banks in certain areas, but without holding full banking licenses enabling them to pay interest and accept deposits, does this mean that technically these aren't banks?
Yeah, there are a number of different flavours of this. And as you say, it really depends on the suite of services and products that you as an institution offer that will then dictate and drive the regulatory permissions and licence that you need to be able to achieve to offer those onward services. So again, for example, there's some generic areas of regulatory focus and scrutiny across all regulated firms, such as AML, financial crime. But then there will be different areas of focus depending on the nature of the service that you offer, which could include the safeguarding of funds example, as I said, or other things around how complaints are handled and managed across different contexts and different environments. So yeah, it really is central to the regulatory footprints that firms do not mislead, and firms are very clear on what services they are able to offer. But there can be a bit of a pick and mix across different organisations and institutions as to what they want to offer, which will then dictate how they onward deliver those services.
Now, a number of these UK firms have taken the decision not to have physical branch locations for their customers to visit. This lack of high street presence means that these companies have to utilise innovative methods for conducting their Know Your Customer KYC checks. How do you deal with this?
Yeah, so I mean, I think it's probably fair to say that there is a general shift across the regulatory environment to move away from or take more advantage of digital onboarding processes. COVID in part probably emphasised the importance of that. We've seen retail banking footprints reduce in size as well, and also the move in general to more online digital identification. So whilst it's obviously a particular requirement for businesses or regulated entities that don't have a physical presence, I think it's much more of a general theme in the industry, in which businesses are looking at how they can reduce and improve the client onboarding process. It's a huge area of focus for the sector, whether it's the human capital we need, the process development, the regulatory technology and infrastructure that's required to do that. And the principles broadly remain the same in that, you know, we need to start from a very solid foundation of, do we understand the risks associated with the products, services that we're taking to market, and the types of people that we would expect to be wanting to access and use that? And can we make sure that, having understood that risk, we focus and tailor our due diligence processes, both onboarding and ongoing, to target those and make sure we mitigate those issues and risks and drive the right level of understanding of the customer to allow us to manage that relationship properly. So things like, how do we communicate the onboarding requirements to customers is very key. Speaking in plain English so that we try and reduce the amount of jargon and information that's available to them, so they understand what we're asking for, why we're asking for it, and therefore are better equipped to deal with that information. How we then gather the information, maintain it, online portals, services, etc., is increasingly important. Accessing relevant sources of reliable information, golden sources of verification, that kind of thing. And then making the connection that's been talked about in the sector for a number of years between solid due diligence from a financial crime and anti-money laundering standpoint are also real strong commercial enablers. Because if you understand your customer well, you understand what you expect them to do, you can better serve them. So those two things are very important for any business, particularly a growing business like Modulr.
In Modular, how do you investigate unusual customer behavior / transactional activity to identify suspicious activity which may be indicative of money laundering or terrorist financing?
It follows fairly consistent principles and parallels to any regulated business. It's starting from what's the sort of activity we would expect to see from this client? How do we make sure that we assess and monitor the sorts of activity and behaviours that they are demonstrating to ensure that's in line with what we expect? Accessing external sources of information, whether it's around broader themes and trends around particular sectors, specific bits of intelligence or insight from partners or from law enforcement, and using that as a trigger for an investigation, doing specific targeted analytics on our platform to look at things that maybe would seem to be normal in one context but could drive and identify red flags. And also frontline staff awareness, so particularly those individuals and customer facing, making sure that they are equipped to understand that individuals who maybe operate or clients that are engaging in a slightly unusual way, appear to be behaving slightly unusually, are also red flags and things that we would expect and look to be brought to our attention to investigate. So it's that combination of monitoring of transactional activity, looking at the ongoing due diligence files of the customers to make sure we understand who they are and what they're doing and identify any changes. Frontline staff awareness so that they can flag anything that they identify that may appear unusual or of interest, and accessing a structured but broad source of external information so that we can very quickly look to overlay that into our book and see if there are any items that are of interest and relevance to us. I think also when you operate like Modular on a partner-based model, but also look at certain sectors, we can take quite good advantage of things like the National Risk Assessment that allow us then to tailor particular bits of analytics on threats that may be faced by certain sectors, whether it's a travel sector or accountancy, payroll, that kind of thing, and then start to do some more deeper engagement with relevant stakeholders, both inside and outside of the organisation, to deal with it.
Just sticking on the topic of SARS, the UK FIU has a number of working groups and engages with a variety of different sectors to try and help improve the quality of SARS. What kind of interaction do you have with the UK FIU and how beneficial is it?
So we are in a fortunate position. We are able to chair one of those working groups. So the PEF working group is a combination of firms that one of my colleagues, Stuart, chairs the regular quarterly meetings. That gives us a number of benefits and a number of opportunities. So one is to talk about the particular challenges at an infrastructure level for organisations like ourselves and how we do the practicalities of reporting suspicions, how we interact and engage with the NCA, how we understand some of the challenges the NCA themselves experience in terms of how they have to handle, manage the large volumes. We can better tailor the communication and better understand what things we can do to achieve good outcomes. It's also a good opportunity for us to talk about themes that emerge across the various institutions, and the NCA can act as a gateway to bring in specialists either from other working groups or from other law enforcement agencies that may be able to provide a particular perspective. And there's also, for example, in the recent Russian-Ukraine situation, an opportunity for us to get together on a more targeted basis to talk about a conversation around how firms are handling that, what's the best practice, any ideas we can do. And again, the NCA have been a great support in helping to facilitate that contact and that communication across the board. So that is one example of a very sort of hands-on, regular and practical support that the NCA and FIU have been able to provide us in the market. And one that I know that a lot of the firms that we work with are very keen to take advantage of and further access.
Well, that brings us to the end of this edition of the UK FIU podcast. I do hope you've enjoyed it. And if you'd like to know more about the UK FIU and the SARS regime, don't forget you can follow us on LinkedIn and Twitter. And our pages on the NCA website have lots of useful guidance on there, including the most recent edition of the UK FIU magazine, SARS in Action. I'd like to thank my panellist, Mike Venn, for taking part today. And I'd just like to conclude by saying that a further consideration when categorising SARS reporters is that the range of services they provide do not remain fixed. Just because a financial company does not currently hold a UK banking licence does not mean that it never will. When an institution obtains its banking licence, its role as a salary porter can change because, for instance, the financial intelligence provided on current account users is different to that where prepaid card is used. Using the above understanding of what constitutes a challenger bank, again in inverted speech marks, means that it is then easier to realign definitions when circumstances change. For those involved in the SARS regime day to day, it is crucial to clarify what we mean when we group reporter types. Understanding who SAR reporters are and the services they offer their customers means categorising them clearly. Much as challenger bank can be a useful term to use, it is important that it is done so accurately and with consistency. So, thank you for listening. I've been David Maguire, and this has been another UK FIU podcast.
This is the UK Financial Intelligence Unit podcast.